Hello and welcome to the Scottish Song Guide with the Sorries. I'm Marty.
And I'm Douglas.
And today we're going to talk about the song Loch Lomond. Now, when we thought about doing this, we thought, okay, this is going to be a nice easy one, slam dunk, straightforward, central to the culture, no bother. Wrong.
Oh, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low. And I'll be in Scotland afore ye. For me and my true love will never meet again. By the bonny, bonny banks, oh Loch Lomond.
First of all, Doug, why don't you tell everyone just a little introduction to what we don't know about this song?
Well, I thought that before we delve in deeper, we might kind of work backwards a little bit, because I think it might be good actually to look at this song and its place in the culture, because it's not really a song that figures very highly at all, really, in our set. You know, we've done a recording of it, but we haven't played it live in its regular form.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, I would argue that this is probably worldwide the best known Scottish song. I mean, obviously there's Auld Lang Syne.
Aye.
But Auld Lang Syne isn't really regarded, I don't think, as a specifically Scottish song. People know it from New Year, obviously, and they know that it comes from somewhere, but it's not necessarily thought of as a song which is really identified with Scotland, whereas Loch Lomond absolutely is. You know, part of the evidence for that would be the number of American versions that have been done of it. I mean, in the sort of 20th century, from the very start, there was a version by a singer, Henry Burr, who's actually a Canadian, and he sang a version of it which was really popular. He also actually went on to sing Are You Lonesome Tonight with a strong Scottish burr.
Really?
But then there's the versions in the 30s. Maxine Sullivan, who went on with her husband to become the first black artist to have a weekly radio slot, but she did a jazz version, basically, of Loch Lomond.
Was this with Benny Goodman?
No.
Was that the one with the Benny Goodman Orchestra?
No, this was just before the one with Benny Goodman. So this became a big hit, and then 3 months after, it was Martha Tilton, I think, did it with Benny Goodman. But, I mean, and both of those versions are actually great versions. But before I'd heard that, I'd heard Ella Fitzgerald doing it, which was she really goes wild with it and scats all over it and so on.
She's unbelievable, Ella Fitzgerald. She's so good.
Funnily enough, I also found as we were, when I was looking into some of these, an Ella Fitzgerald song called McPherson is Rehearsing, which has, is very definitely, you know, talks about bagpipes and has a phrase from the US Tramping song in it, you know, come along,
really?
Come along, yeah. But one of my favourite versions, which everybody should seek out, it's not really a version, but it uses the main refrain from Loch Lomond, the "You'll Take the High Road," is in the song Something to Believe In on the 1990 classic album Flesh and Blood by LA rockers Poison.
AC/DC are supposed to have done a version of Loch Lomond, but I've not found it. But
wouldn't surprise me with Bon Scott having been a pipe band drummer in Fremantle when he moved over there from Kirriemuir, and obviously the Young Brothers being Glasgow born. But anyway, we're slightly digressing. I mean, that's internationally, but in terms of our lifetimes, its place in the culture is quite interesting. And I mean, the thing which feels a little bit difficult to say on a podcast about Scottish songs, but I think is fair enough, is the fact that I could not stand this song when I was younger. Like, I thought it was the most twee, kilts and haggis, shortbread tin, utter, it's like all the language in it put my teeth on edge. And pretty much
and then Runrig came along.
Well, yes, and Runrig basically have rehabilitated the song, I think, for probably quite a lot of people.
Yeah, I think
especially with their live version. But actually, my turning point with it was when I heard the Corrie's version, which we'll come to a bit later. And it totally just changed my opinion about the song. And it made me think completely differently about the song.
Well, it's much longer, as you said. We'll talk about it a bit later, but it is much longer. And it's also a very different kind of seeing. It's the same story, roughly, but it's seen through a completely different lens. And it freshens it and takes it out of that cheesiness, for want of a better word. And it's because it was so ubiquitous in the early part of the 20th century, I think, that it became like that for and I absolutely am with you 100%. It was this thing, it's like, no, there's absolutely no way. And if someone had told you that you'd record a version of it when you were in your teens, you'd have thought,
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, there's a lot of things that if people had said to me in my teens, I'd have done then. I might have thought about ending it. But anyway, because I mean, that's the thing that we have. I mean, it's a tune which we sometimes include when we're doing little instrumentals, and or if we've done little Cayley sets, we bring in a bit of Loch Lomond.
Absolutely, and I think that. For me, the rehabilitation is partly through Run Rig, basically because it's a tune to bounce about to. Despite the fact that some critics have said that any kind of optimistic, upbeat version of this song is inane chirpiness. I think that's a little harsh. But I think also for me, it was actually finding out the story behind the song anyway, the original song. And it wasn't that completely changed it, but once I understood what was supposed to be going on, it made it much more powerful for me. I kind of revisited the lyrics and sort of understood it a little bit. If we're looking at the short, what I'm going to call the short version, which is the one that kind of everyone knows, the one that we were just declaiming as being a bit cheesy, that version of the song is either a Jacobite prisoner talking, who's about to be executed in Carlisle, and indeed he's talking to his lover who's made the trip to bid him farewell. Or the other one is the same Jacobite prisoner, who's possibly a man called Donald MacDonald. There's some copies of it that they think that it's actually a specific prisoner supposed to be speaking, who exists in history and who was executed in Carlisle in 1746 after the Jacobite rebellion. But in this case, the other version of it has him talking to his comrade in arms who'd been spared. Now, the interesting thing about both these interpretations is that everyone assumes it's a guy in Carlisle. I didn't know that when I was younger, by the way. Mm. That this was the fact. When I understood this kind of historical background, it kind of meant a bit more to me. But Carlisle's not mentioned at any point in the song. It's just that people say things like, legend has it, and it's commonly thought that. And, you know, there's very good reason for that.
Yeah.
Because what happened after Culloden was that a load of the Jacobite prisoners were indeed taken to Carlisle. And there, they were given the traditional Roman army punishment of decimation. So what
It's 1 in 10.
That's right. Yeah, you draw lots, and if you're the unlucky 1 in 10, you die. So it's thought to be on the back of this that this is the prisoner talking about his execution, basically, and his impending death. So when he says, I'll take the low road, obviously, that's him travelling through the underworld to get back to Loch Lomond. Now, Murray Pittock says that it's actually based on an erotic song from the 18th century, and it's actually a Jacobite reworking of that. He says that the short form that we're talking about, the You Take the High Road and the Beyond Bonnie Banks, all that stuff, is it needs to be read as an allegory for the Jacobite cause, so that the true love in question is not actually a literal lover, it's the Jacobite cause itself, or indeed kind of the representation of it by Bonnie Prince Charlie. So he's dying for his king.
And that might actually have been further twisted in one of the broadsides where it appears, where it's actually entitled, rather than Loch Lomond or the Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond, Flora's Lament for Her Charlie, which takes the song and it starts off the same way as the other versions. It's Yon Bonnie Banks and Yon Bonnie Braes. And the chorus is virtually the same. But then the song goes on and it's basically almost it's a lament, obviously, from Flora MacDonald to Bonnie Prince Charlie. Obviously, a complete, this is a mid-19th century broadside.
Yeah.
Complete invention.
Yeah. Except insofar as, obviously, Flora, it's the love of the cause and the love of Bonnie Prince Charlie himself kind of blend into one another.
Yeah.
And that's why it becomes ludicrous, but it's really kind of it's symbolism much as anything else.
Where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love were ever wont to gae, on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. He'll tuck the high road and I'll tuck the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore you.
So, the version that we sing on our album is a longer version, which is slightly different from this one I've been talking about with the voice of the Jacobite prisoner.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I first heard the Corries singing this. And what kind of hooked me into it was the story was there, and maybe it was a lot more obvious, the sort of theme of the dead Highlander and then going via the underworld to meet again as lover. But the original, I mentioned earlier, the sort of tweeness, and one of the facts that it has become played as a kind of chirpy, cheery song is because when you listen, particularly just the first two verses in the chorus, I mean, it could be a tourist board theme song, you know. It's like, oh, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low road. Oh, and I'll be in Scotland before you. You know, it's like two people racing via different routes to Loch Lomond.
They have sections. They have sections of it. Of the song and a little bit about it on the kind of Trossachs website.
Well, that's it. It's the, you know, the if we're in deep purple hue, the Healing Hills will view, and so on. I mean,
yeah,
that's it. Whereas this version that you're talking about, the one that we did, the longer one, is completely different in many senses. We have what seems to be a woman out walking alone and meets someone, and she's asked, you know, where she's wandering at that point. Alone, and she's, you know, I trusted my ain love, the nicht in the broom, my Ranald wha loves me so dearly, but the morrow he marches ten but a tune to fecht for his king and Prince Charlie. So right there, we have immediately, right, Jacobite cause. We know we know what's happening. And it goes on, and then the verse which we don't sing, simply because when we recorded it, I hadn't heard the verse, or hadn't read the verse, where actually we get this kind of Romeo and Juliet thing of, first of all, she has a premonition that the soldier is going to die, and then he does die, and then she basically says, oh, well, you know, there's a place laid for me in the graveyard and I'm going to kill myself.
Well, I've always read that or thought about that as being like, if he has indeed died, I'll kill myself, but maybe not.
Right. Yeah, well, I suppose.
But basically, the consolation that she's offered by the person she's speaking to is, what are you getting so upset about? He's going to come back, he'll be a war hero, you'll be his girlfriend, everyone will know it, and it's just fantastic. He'll be at the height of his fame, he'll be really brilliant, and it's going to be fantastic, and then you won't be crying anymore, will you?
Yeah, but that bit that she says, that the sort of premonition bit, was again, that was one of the bits that really got me, you know, but his arms and his breath were as cold as the death, and his heart's blood ran red on the heather, you know.
It's a really, it's redolent of really old ballads, that though, isn't it?
Yeah,
that imagery is so kind of vivid and horrific, actually. It's horrible. It is like a nightmare. The idea of being bride and bridegroom, and then this scene, actually, her awareness that he's her bridegroom and he's dead.
For ye stream in my sleep, we stood bride and bridegroom together, but his arms and his breath were as cold as the death, and his heart's blood ran red in the heather.
So Marty, in saying that, you know, that's kind of reminiscent of some really old ballads. What do we know about the age of it? Where can it be traced to? When can it be traced to?
Well, this was for everything.
Pause and draw of breath. Well, as always.
This was where things got
maybe quite as clear.
It got kind of complicated. So, it's the idea that it's a Jacobite reworking of a really old song. Some people have said, you know, you've got this Donald MacDonald thing, and that it's actually kind of like Macpherson's Farewell or Macpherson's Rant, where it's just, you know, him talking from the gallows, basically. It's actually like it's written down by the person at the scene. But I think that's probably unlikely. Nice idea, but it's probably as likely as it was for Macpherson's Rant. On the other hand, it looks like it makes its appearance in the kind of first half of the 19th century. So you can go back a little bit. It starts coming up in collections in the latter part of the 19th century, in the sort of 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. But Lady John Scott is the name to whom it's often attributed. Now, she was born in 1810, dies in 1900, at the fair old age of 90. And she's a really interesting character. She wrote Annie Laurie. Yeah. And she was quite open that she'd written the tune for it and then reworked someone else's words.
Yeah.
So she's no reason to tell Porky's, partly because she's not actually trying to make any money out of her songs. It's not important. Yeah.
Well, she's
her.
A kind of border landowner.
Yeah, that's
isn't
right.
She? So she didn't really need to be making money.
Well, even her most famous one, Annie Laurie, if indeed we say that Annie Laurie is the most famous one, it was the 19th century equivalent of a charity single. Well, it was published first. In aid of the widows and orphans of the Crimean War.
Do they know it's Annie Laurie?
So anyway, Lady John Scott, she was wrote under that name. She was actually Alicia Ann Spottiswood, who married the, I think, fourth son of the Duke of Buccleuch. Yeah. And she had written to people and said that she had written this song down, written Loch Lomond down, from the singing of a poor little boy who was singing it in the streets of Edinburgh. Now, people have rubbished this and said, this is absolute nonsense. You know, a little boy in the streets of Edinburgh wouldn't use language like the ballad uses. But I think that's a little unfair, actually, because people learn songs. And it's necessary.
And
he maybe didn't write it, but he might have maybe knew it.
Yeah, but also the thought that there were, in the 19th century, no Highland families in Edinburgh who
exactly.
might have had this, anyway, is ridiculous, of course.
Yeah. So I think that's absolutely true. Another thing is, Lady John Scott, Alicia Spottiswood, actually, her niece, her grandniece, when she wrote about her in the kind of beginning of the 20th century, said that she used to collect songs from when she was a very young child. She would actually write down songs that she heard. So it's not as if she doesn't have a bit of previous in this, that she did do that. Plus, she also wrote Jacobite songs herself, which is why some people have said, oh, she wrote this. But actually, a version of the words of this, are first of all published in about 1841. Well, it's supposed to have been published in Thomson and Dunn's Vocal Melodies of Scotland. But if you go looking in those volumes, it's not there, which is kind of very confusing. And then you come across James Fuld, who in the 1970s explained what had gone on, which is that there's a broadsheet ballad which was published in Edinburgh. There's a copy of it in the British Library, they say circa 1840. And Fuld says that on the back of that ballad, they said it was going to be published in the Vocal Melodies of Scotland, but it never was published in the Vocal Melodies of Scotland.
Well, yeah.
So it's not in the main collection, but it nevertheless exists as if it was. So the only other thing about that is that, and this is why I think maybe there was a kid involved, is that there were earlier versions. There's certainly one in 1838 that's published in Edinburgh by Sanderson, another broadside ballad, but again, I've not been able to find a copy of it, so I don't exactly know how it relates to the main lyrics that we would know. Robert Ford, at the end of the 19th century, says that he thinks that Lady John Scott, he believes her, basically, that he thinks she probably did actually write it down. And I tend to agree with him, because her own Jacobite songs, it's all about, there's a, in fact, they do the same twist that the version that you sing, that we did, which is that actually there's a sense of meeting in the hereafter. And that's something that's a real strain in kind of 19th century Victorian Jacobitism. This idea that, you know, it's terribly sad, but we'll meet in the hereafter. So there's a little edge of optimism. Whereas in this song, in its kind of original form, it doesn't seem to be there. It seems to be just bemoaning the fact that, you know, we'll never meet again.
Yeah. And there's also, in that note by Robert Ford in 1899, he also says that there's a, was it a Mr. Crippen of Crieff who had said that he had heard it 60 years before, which would tie in time-wise to roundabout then.
Do you know what I really love about that, though? It's specific. He says Crieff in Glasgow. Now, the Glasgow thing aside, but it's the Crieff thing that he really talks about and that appears elsewhere. Lady John Scott, one of her favourite places to visit was Ferntower Castle in Crieff. So the plot thickens.
But then there's also, again, Robert Ford, he then published his song histories in 1901, which was just a year after Alicia Spottiswoode's death, Lady Jane Scott's death. And he mentions there that the verses which we sing, which I was talking about earlier, she had heard them years before from the singing of a child in Edinburgh.
There's a child in there's a stray waif from Broadford in the Isle of Skye is mentioned in some versions as well, but I think we can discount that. But one thing I was going to say about Alicia Spottiswoode is she's an incredible character because she pioneered a bit of the archaeology in the far north of Scotland. In around Thurso, they've got websites talking about how she actually helped and paid for some of the digs of the brochs around Thurso. She bought a boat for the fishermen of Fair Isle because she found out they were being ripped off because they couldn't afford to get their catch to the bigger markets. So they were having to take what price they were given. So she just bought them a boat and gave it to them. And she once walked 15 miles in 3 hours for a bet because her brother at the breakfast table had casually remarked that he didn't think any woman would ever be able to do such a thing. So she just went, really? Okay, have you got your watch? I think she sounds like an absolute brilliant character.
And what is, you know, not entirely unique, but is quite unique for the period is that she's writing words and tunes for these things. Now, I know, actually, funnily enough, another great female songwriter, Carolina Oliphant, as well, was said to have written some of the tunes as well as the words to certain songs. But yeah, certainly Lady John Scott was definitely a musician.
She apparently accompanied herself on the harp, but she rarely wrote down the accompaniment. She just wrote down the melody lines usually.
Well, of course, a lot of these, when you look at the old song collections, most famously probably with George Thompson, you know, they're farmed out to some big composers of the day who write arrangements. And sometimes that's people based in Edinburgh. In the case of George Thompson and his songs, you know, it's Haydn and Beethoven that are arranging all these songs.
In the case of Loch Lomond, the initial version in 1841 attributed it, I think, as saying that it was written by a lady and arranged by Finlay Dunne.
Yeah, you're saying there that it's credited to a lady, and we presume Lady John Scott.
Yeah.
But actually, the tune has earlier roots. And I think it's something that I seem to say on pretty much every episode of this, the tune seems to be based on something else. But I think the tune that we know for Loch Lomond is very much based on an earlier tune, which is variously known as either Kind Robin Lose Me, Loves Me, or it's sometimes called Robin Cushy. And I think it's first in McGibbon's A Collection of Scots Tunes back in 1742 that Robin Cushy appears, and you can definitely pick out phrases of that which are
It even predates the 45 then.
Yeah, the melody, yeah.
Yeah.
And it then appears, Kind Robin Lose Me is in Nathaniel Gow's Repository of Original Scots Slow Strathspeys and Dances, another one of our great 19th century snappy titles. But that's a collection of Neil Gow and Nathaniel Gow tunes in 1817. Neil Gow's dead by then. And again, if you play that's really close to Loch Lomond as we know it. So, yeah, it seems that the tune has predated these. Interestingly, when I was looking into this a bit more, some people were saying that the air was based on Peggy, I Must Love Thee, which is even earlier. You know, it appears actually in the Orpheus Caledonius in 1725. But I think that's in the Blakey manuscript from the late 17th century. And there's chat about links to Purcell and everybody. But the point is that that's a much more tenuous link, I think. You know, there's maybe one bar in 16 which you think, oh, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
And it's funny because as we were chatting after recording one of the podcasts the other week about how a lot of these tunes and the words, it's a little bit like, you know, sampling nowadays where you get acts taking a riff from an old song or something and building a completely new song around it.
Yeah. So it's related, but not necessarily the same song.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's worth mentioning as well that there is an Irish song called Red as the Rose, which uses exactly the same tune as Loch Lomond, as the kind of modern version of Loch Lomond. And the Clancy family were... the Clancy family were adamant that they had... that this was the origin of the tune, and actually the Scots had nicked it.
But what do you think about... I mean, do you think there's much in that?
I think... You could never dismiss anything, particularly, because of what we're dealing with here. But it seems to me, I actually agree with some critics that think Red as the Rose just seems a little bit more formalised as a lyric.
Right.
And I also think that there's a lot of evidence that you've just talked about just now of this song appearing in Scotland way back. It's not as if there wasn't any commerce between Scotland and Ireland at the time, mind you.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can dismiss it out of hand, but I think what this says to me as well is that there's certainly plenty of printed versions of this song, both the music and the lyrics, but the whole thing is coming out of the oral tradition as well. So you're getting these multiple versions of different songs using similar tunes, the same tunes, completely different lyrics, slightly different lyrics, and they're all kind of mushrooming within the course of 20 or 30 years. And I think that's just how the oral tradition's going to work. That's why it's very difficult trying to get a handle and kind of go, right, it's there. That's where it starts. Because that's just not what's happening here. There's like live culture which is operating and working on these things, just as the Bonnie Lass of Fife, we were talking about that last week. It's very much the same case here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true what you're saying about the oral tradition. And in fact, the tune and the words don't appear in print together until 1876 in William Christie's Traditional Ballads.
Probably when it had settled down a little bit and people could agree on what they were supposed to be doing with the words and the music at the same time. So basically you're looking at it being generated over the course of over 100 years, arguably, if you take the 45 as the starting point.
The thistle bloom, the king hazy, fond lovers will meet in the gloaming, and me and my true love will yet meet again, far above the bonny banks o' Loch Lomond. I will take the high road.
Well, there you are. That's our take on Loch Lomond. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you are now a wee bit more aware, at least, of the complexities that we discovered when we were trying to trace the roots of even a fairly obvious or simple song, we thought.
Yeah. If you have enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe on all the sort of main podcast platforms. And you can leave us a review. That would be really nice. Only assuming you enjoyed it, obviously.
Nice review.
And you can find some of our resources and a bit further reading on the Scottish Song Guide website, scottishsongguide.com. And we will see you again next week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.